This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
So it took me 3 months to go blind. So I would pick up a book and be able to read it, and then a week later pick up the book and not be able to read it, and then, you know, a week later not be able to find the book. I was bossy as a child. I've always been really adventurous, and I just fell in love with the world of work.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. On this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Liz Jackson, MBE. Liz is currently the Sales and Marketing Director at Initium Corporate Finance, but her story, her journey to get to that job is a really interesting one. At the age of two, Liz was diagnosed with a degenerative eye disorder, which meant that by the time she was 25, she was blind. Now, what's remarkable in this story is that's the exact age when she set up her award-winning company, Great Guns Marketing. She started the company with a grant from the Prince's Trust in 1998, and it was hugely successful. And so I'm really interested to hear about Liz's journey and how she's been such a successful entrepreneur, and all about the book she wrote, Startup, to help entrepreneurs get on in business. So, Liz, I'd like to start at the beginning, if we can. Welcome to the podcast. Tell us about your early life and your education.
So I was born on the Isle of Sheppey. So it's a great place to be born, and grew up in Kent, moved to Hampshire with my dad's job when I was 11. Interestingly, I'm blind now, but I wasn't born blind. I have an eyesight condition called RP, which meant I had tunnel vision. And at the time in Kent, education tended to exclude people with disabilities in mainstream education. So there was a fight on my parents' hands every quarter, really, to keep me in mainstream education and not to put me in a boarding school for severely disabled children. And so it was a bit of relief when we moved to Hampshire and I went to secondary school, and Hampshire had an inclusion policy in education. But I, at that point, had got to the stage where I wanted to keep my disability entirely secret. So I forbade my parents to tell my school that I had an eyesight disability. And so I winged it all the way through GCSEs and secondary school, and got by with all sorts of different tactics. I obviously didn't do amazingly well academically. I left with, you know, 9 GCSEs, but 1 A in drama, and the rest were ungraded.
So how did you manage to do that, Liz? How did you keep that quiet? Because I'm sure you couldn't have looked at the blackboard or the whiteboard or whatever boards they had.
Well, I had tunnel vision and night blindness. So fundamentally, I didn't have any peripheral vision. So as long as I sat fairly near a board, I could see it. But I could see about a third of a word at a time when I was reading. I could see a ball if it didn't go outside of that sort of tunnel that I could see through. And I think that's probably where I, you know, learn quite a lot of my entrepreneurial skills, because you've got to think outside the box every hour of every day. How do I get through this without anyone guessing? And what are my disruptive techniques that I'm going to use to make the class laugh so no one notices? You know, and no surprises, I did really, really well in drama, possibly because of that. But I didn't really enjoy school, and I think probably because I couldn't interact quite so much from a psych perspective, I sort of disengaged quite a bit in the academic area.
And was there anything in those early years that pointed to you being an entrepreneur?
No, none, not at all. Apart from the fact I get excited and passionate about ideas and tended to give lots of things a go. So, you know, I'd watch a program on wild camping and then decide that me and my mates were all going to go and sleep next to the stream that night without any planning. It was just something we were going to do. So I've always been really adventurous and, you know, a bit of a fire starter in that regard.
And as you kind of went through those early years, did you have any idea about what you wanted to do as a job?
I had no idea. I'd done some work experience, which my dad kindly organised. He worked for a brilliant tech company and I was able to go in for a week or so and make lots of men coffee, which I wasn't that excited about. I'd gone through ideas. I wanted to be a zookeeper when I was 8. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I had no idea what the world of work was like. I hated the idea of a desk job. So absolutely no idea what I wanted to do all the way through school.
Tell us then about your first job. So you were at school, you didn't particularly enjoy it. Obviously, the academic side was incredibly difficult for you with your eyesight. So how did you get your first job? And tell us about the first job and tell us about your coping strategies there, because you're going to become more exposed, aren't you?
Yeah. So I got my first job for an apprenticeship. I don't know if you remember an initiative called YTS, but that's how I got my first job. And my college recommended it because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I went to college to do retakes, basically just didn't turn up very much. And so they called my parents, got me in and said, you need to get a job because academia isn't the right route. So she lined me up with an interview with an entrepreneur who had previously sold 2 companies. So this was his third startup. I was going to be the first non-family member of the team. And I remember going for that interview that they'd lined up. My mum drove me to make sure I'd get there and go in. And I remember feeling a weight of responsibility on me to get that job, partly because I was starting to think that people might believe I was a bit of a loser because I hadn't really had any success yet in life. And I was starting to wonder, you know, am I a bit of a loser? So I really wanted to get this job so I could look the guy in the eye at that time and just absolutely deployed every bit of energy that I possibly could to persuade him that if he didn't hire me, it was going to be the worst decision of his career ever. And really, like, thankfully he did. He offered me the job on the spot. And I started that Monday. And he obviously did pretty quickly work out that admin wasn't a huge skill of mine. But he had that skill that entrepreneurs do often have in abundance, which is to recognize raw talent in people. And he said, look, I've heard you answer the phone, I've heard the conversations you have with clients, I honestly think you might be gifted at sales. And he got me started in my first job, if you like, which was telemarketing, and it just turned out I was brilliant.
and so what were you selling in those early days?
Yeah, it was an export consultancy firm. And so the business identified agents and distributors overseas for manufacturing companies here in the UK. So my job was to ring managing directors, tell them about what we were doing, and get a sales appointment for my boss to go and see them. He was pretty gifted, so he converted lots of those into clients. And after a while, he said, look, can you go and find some other people like you who can make sales appointments? And then I led the team. And then a few years after that, he asked me to go into North America and set up our sales operation over there. And I just fell in love with the world of work. And he just showed me how exciting work was, how building businesses just gave me so much satisfaction, the thrill of winning, you know, winning and winning again and competing and winning. I just absolutely fell in love with all of it.
And for those people out there who are thinking that they might want to go into a sales career, tell me about the skills that you had that made you successful so that they understand what they will need to have to be successful.
Character. I think resilience. Sales has always more failure than success in it, even for the best person in the job. You know, you'll always fail more. Because even if you've got a 1 in 3 conversion rate, you know, you've lost 2 to everyone you win. So you've got to be pretty resilient. And I think, being comfortable in your own skin, and being just really diligent in learning loads about what you do and how you can help and who you want to sell to. Because you do become an advisor. So I think you've just got to be really naturally inquisitive. And I also think it really doesn't hurt to be, you know, quite funny. People buy from people they trust, respect, can learn from and like. And so those are the kind of characteristics that, you know, I look for in people when we recruit them. But there's just a real love for what you do, I think. People can, you know, they buy into visions when someone's got a vision, and they believe in something. If you don't believe in what you're doing, then you can't really persuade someone else to get on board. So you've got to be wholehearted in your pursuit of what you're doing, I think.
And for those people listening to this podcast who are actually in sales, but perhaps struggling a bit, what tips would you give them? What tips do you give somebody to be a great salesperson?
For me, it's about relationships. So, you know, I have a tendency to help first. So I'll often give away time and ideas in order to build a relationship. I don't think you can be very transactional these days in sales. I think it's all about building trust and relationship, and never be one of those desperate people. I just think old sales techniques just don't work anymore. I think the world of sales has really turned on its head, and I think so much of what we do is about doing the right thing for the client at the right time, whether it means you win the client or not. And if you don't win that client, then they're more likely to refer someone into you who is the right client. So I think it's just about having a really good moral compass and making sure you understand what your values are, your company values, and look for clients where those values and objectives align.
And how, Liz, would you describe the old world of sales, if that's a new world?
Well, you know, we all remember, you know, these sort of pretty premeditated conversations where, you know, people would sit there and stare people in the eyes until, you know, they'd ask for the order, and there would be a, you know, a long silence, and someone would break the, you know, and you know, these pretty awful things where double glazing people would camp on people's front lawns. You know, I just think that whole world as well of doing the numbers, you know, if you make 100 phone calls, one person will say yes. I don't think that world's relevant anymore. I think it's about really deciding who it is you want to work with, and spending a lot of energy tailoring messaging and how you're going to engage with that person to that, you know, that particular situation. So it's much more thought that goes into each initiative as opposed to just throwing mud at the wall.
And let's just talk about your next step then, because you started with BCMS. You were obviously clearly really successful, but you decided that you wanted to work for yourself. So why did you decide that? What turned you from being an employee, a very successful employee in a fast-growing business? And as you said, you did all sorts of super things, setting up new telephone centers in the UK, in America. You know, you were clearly on a fantastic trajectory, but all of a sudden, or I don't know if it was all of a sudden, you decided that you wanted to work for yourself. How did that happen?
Just didn't want to climb the career ladder. I just wanted to be the boss. And I didn't want to sort of work my way up. I wanted to be the CEO. And so I felt that the quickest way to accelerate that was to start my own company. I also saw a gap. You know, I outsourced a lot of our marketing initiatives, and I was pretty disappointed with a lot of the agencies that we used. And I thought I could do a better job. And so really the seed of the idea came from, you know, from those two wants, if you like.
And did you have that in your childhood? I know we've talked a little about your childhood, but was there anything there that always made you want to be the boss, the one in charge, the one in control?
I was bossy as a child, and I'm one of four, so I'm the oldest. And like I said, you know, if I came up with an idea that we were going to go wild camping, we were going wild camping that night. And so I was always the one who, you know, suggested the ideas and things. But that's probably it, really, in terms of entrepreneurship.
Okay, so you're doing really well in your current business. You've seen a gap in the market. You've decided you want to work for yourself and press on. And then the next thing you need is you need some money to do that. So tell us about the Prince's Trust and going there and how they helped.
Yeah, so I went to the bank first, which was really depressing. But they did allow me to open a business bank account. And I also went to see my then boss and said, look, I'm thinking of starting my own business. What do you think? And I mean, what a wonderful, gracious, incredible entrepreneur. He just turned around and said, Liz, do it. You'll be brilliant and we'll be your first client. So I had the confidence that I was going to have some revenue as well. So then I went to the Prince's Trust, which was a recommendation from the bank manager. That was a bit like Dragon's Den, but really super kind and supportive. But also pretty, you know, it was in depth. They don't just give money away to anyone. They, you know, they do, they're responsible in their giving. And so I had a business plan that I needed to present, and they gave me a lot of confidence because they loaned me the maximum they could, which was 4,000, and they gave me a grant of 1,000. So I was able to start the business with £5,000.
And when you look back at that time, what are your fondest memories and what are the things that make you now go, oh, that was a bit scary at the time?
Oh, yeah, I can't even remember. I think probably it was in the end of the first year when we ended up having to move from a garage because I'd filled a garage with 8 people, and we were at capacity. And also I found out you're not allowed to run a business from home unless you have planning permission. So the council told me I needed to shut it or move it. And I think it was the first time I took commercial premises because the hike, you know, in outgoing costs were huge compared to the situation I was currently in. So I think that was probably one of the scariest things. I think the fondest things were just building a team in those early days. It was just, you know, super fun, just so fun, you know, working with sales and marketing people. It's always super fun, you know, just having objectives and goals and hitting them and celebrating with the team when we had hit them and finding new and creative ways of celebrating. It was just great. I really loved it.
And it was at that time, Liz, you lost your sight.
Yeah.
So yeah. What happened with that? How did that impact you?
So I would pick up a book one day and be able to read it. And then a week later, pick up the book and not be able to read it. And then, you know, a week later, not be able to find the book. So it took me 3 months to go blind. To lose my sight entirely. I'm in the 3% of blind people who can't see anything. So I don't have any sight at all. Honestly, just fallen in love and met the man of my dreams. I was running this super exciting business. For me, it was just about finding ways to deal with it. I also have a faith. And so, you know, I have a practice of being, you know, full of gratitude every morning for, you know, this charmed life that I was living and continue to live. It really didn't have much of an impact on me. In fact, I think it was a huge help to the business because, you know, my focus and my gifting has always been selling, winning clients, looking after clients, recruiting great people, and investing my time in, you know, turning them into a really high performing team. That's what gets my motor running. It's what I'm really good at. I never, ever was going to be good at a VAT return or paying the salaries or choosing a server. So I outsourced all of that stuff the minute I went blind. I didn't even attempt to do it. And that's why the business grew at 75% a year for the first 3 years, is because I just focused on the stuff that I was great at and got other people that were great at the other stuff focused on that side of the business. So I'm actually, you know, in a way, deeply grateful that it happened.
And the business that you set up, Great Guns Marketing, you're award winning. You ran it for 17 years, as you said. You know, great from the outset. So tell us about that business and what you really loved about it, and then we'll come on to why you went back to found and do something else.
I mean, when I look at that business, it was a great honor to do it. It was, you know, just a great way, I would say, of kind of growing up and learning the ropes. I would say it was my elongated master's, if you like. You know, I learned loads of stuff, you know, how to hire the right people and how to measure people and how to win clients and develop marketing messages and branding and, you know, all of that great stuff. How to get through really, really hard business times. You know, it was just a wonderful way to grow up. And it was 17 years, and I'm still in touch with loads of the people that I worked with. It was just wonderful. I got to do some really fun, exciting things that you would only get to do through the world of work. You know, I did Secret Millionaire. I wrote a book, like you said earlier. I traveled the world speaking at conferences and events. I impacted our community hugely with the charities and things that we supported. And I just loved it. It was absolutely brilliant.
And so tell us then about leaving that, which obviously sounds huge fun and you clearly enjoyed it, to go to Initium Corporate Finance, where you were a co-owner and you turned the business, obviously reasonably recently, into an employee-owned business, which is really interesting. But you've gone back, you've taken on the role of a director and you look after sales and marketing. So why did you go back to doing that and be part of a bigger corporate again?
So it was a really interesting coming into the world of corporate finance, which was an area that I just didn't know very well. I mean, to be honest, I'm not sure certainly at that stage, you know, I wasn't in that world of, I hadn't gone to private school, so I didn't have loads of entrepreneurial friends who were well connected into private equity or the world of corporate finance. I didn't have, you know, anyone who had been through a business sale or any of those kinds of connections. I just wasn't in those networks. What I didn't know was how you build a business that one day delivers a choice of wanting to leave it. and exit it. And, you know, how do you build a business that's investable? I didn't know any of that. So when I decided to, my business was sold in a really naff way. You know, it still exists today. There's an agency that's bought it in Reading. It wasn't a life-changing thing at all in that respect. So when I joined Initium, it was a consulting assignment. I was doing a day a week for five different companies. And this world of corporate finance, suddenly for me, the world went from black and white to colour. You know, as I started to learn about, you know, the KPIs that really, really mattered when you're building value in a business that someone's going to want to buy into. And it's just such an exciting thing that that day grew to 2 days and then it grew to 3 days. And then I said, oh, do you know what? I'm not excited about the other assignments I'm doing anymore. I want, you know. And so I was then offered a job as a director, and just stepped into this world where, you know, I was working with entrepreneurs all day, every day, helping them build value that delivered that choice that entrepreneurs so deserve. Because everyone thinks that perspiration should, you know, mean that they deserve an aspirational value, and it absolutely doesn't. And so helping people to understand, you know, the blood, sweat, and years that you throw into your business, if you just focus on these areas, it's going to deliver all this choice to you later on. It felt and feels vocational. It just feels like the right thing to do for my fellow entrepreneurs.
And you've now successfully helped over 200 entrepreneurs move their business, sell their business, do what they want with their business, and you've set up the Fellows Group. So tell us about that.
Yeah, so over the last 35 years, this business has sold, it's done about 1,000 transactions. And in recent years, when I joined the business, one of the first things I did was start to talk to our clients who had sold. And what was really interesting is that some of them had sold and, you know, had huge liquidity events, but were deeply unhappy. And a lot of that was to do with the fact that actually what it turned out was a lot of their identity was in the business that they ran. Their friend, you know, their DNA was running through that business. And so, you know, they'd loved being responsible for the 150 people that, you know, they paid every month. And then suddenly that none of that was there anymore. And they had the horror of introducing themselves at a dinner party as retired. And I, you know, I'm starting to meet some of our, we call them fellows, that network's 250 now, that have joined that network. And you know, what it's all about is purpose beyond the sale, and particularly impact beyond the deal, that really matters to us and them. And many, once you've had a liquidity, you know, event and you are still wildly talented and you're brilliant at this, you know, creative gift of starting something from absolutely nothing and scaling it, what your mind kind of turns to is, how do I use those skills and my time that I've now got to leave a legacy and to make my life really super count in the world of kind of impact. And so that's such a joy to be part of that group of 250 who so often, you know, want to share what they've learned from that experience and help the next generation of entrepreneurs, or they want to get involved in the third sector, or they want to invest in impact businesses, those businesses that are going to make the world a better place for the most vulnerable people. You know, whatever it is, I get to connect those dots. And oh, Mark, there's no better job than that.
And tell us about the book you wrote, Startup, to help entrepreneurs start out. Because obviously you're now doing an amazing job at helping people towards the end of that journey
Yeah.
when they're selling, releasing value, deciding what they're going to do next. But obviously your book's all about how to be successful when you start out. So tell us about that.
So it's really funny because when you said about that, I was thinking, I wonder if it's even still in print. So I went onto Amazon and looked it up, and it is still in print
It
because I
is.
wrote that book ages ago. And I don't know where the royalties are going because they don't come to me. so I might drop a note to Penguin. But
Well, sales are going to spike after this podcast again.
great. So I wrote that book. Honestly, I was speaking at an event and someone from Prentice Hall approached me and asked me to write the book. So I didn't have to write a book and then find somebody to publish it. So I was really blessed in that. And I also got to do something that I absolutely loved every minute of, which was I got to write that book with my dad, which was such a, yeah, I loved that. And really, my thoughts around that was just, you know, how do I share what I've learned really, back then. And I think I was probably about 30 when I wrote it. So I really should. I'm probably a bit embarrassed. I think there's one chapter that says, "Think happy thoughts and you can fly." So I think I probably need to write the next one in the sequel.
And tell us from that, for those people listening to this who are inspired by your story and what you've done and setting up your own business, what advice would you give to people who are thinking of being entrepreneurs and setting up their own business?
Be really sure that that's what you want to do. It's not something you take on lightly. I have to say, I much prefer being a co-owner with my 30 co-owners than I did being, a 98% shareholder of my own company. I think it is a wonderful thing to do, but I think you've got to really want to do it. And that's if we're talking about building a business as opposed to going self-employed or, running something, kind of really small from home. Those things are really wonderful, absolutely wonderful things to take control of your own life and do that. But when you come to starting to employ people and job creation and, it isn't easy. And it's not an easy life. It is a wonderful life, but I wouldn't say it's for the faint-hearted. And it is something that you do wholeheartedly. And I have dedicated my whole life practically to learning about being an entrepreneur. And you know what? It still shocks the hell out of me all the time. You think you've got there, and then there's Brexit. And then you think you've got there again, and then there's a pandemic. And then you think you've got there again, and there's wars, or inflation, or something. You have got to be so amazing these days, so resilient. You've got to really know how to build great teams and great people around you, have great family support when you take on and do all of this stuff. I mean, I have got so much respect for the people in our country who take on that role and do that. They are they I just they're special people, really super special people. So be sure that's what you want to do.
Well, that's great advice. Great advice. And tell us about the future for you. What are your plans going forward? Because I mean, we haven't really touched on employee engagement, have we, in terms of employee ownership. So that's now 30 people, and you were saying you'd love that. So just say a little bit about everybody in the business owning the business and the good thing about that and how and why and how you enjoy it.
Well, so, for us, we're, like you say, we're 30 people. And so we're 30 people completely invested in the future of our business, entirely invested in three things, actually, which is clients, colleagues and community. So there are three things that we all care deeply about. I think what the result is and the difference, because we became employee owned in 2022. And so as a business, when you've got 30 co-owners, you're suddenly, there's a need to become very transparent. So, every quarter, everyone knows how much money that there is in the bank. Everyone knows what sales pipeline looks like, what our deal pipeline looks like. And we share our vision really, really regularly. We share our scorecard and our KPI, so everyone knows how we're performing against that. And actually, we've all got ownership of the future and can all impact the direction of the business. And it's amazing. Our employee NPS is 79. Our client NPS is 78, which is a net promoter score. Best place to work with the Sunday Times. And I think all of that is just because it's ours. This is our company, and it's up to us where we end up. And that's real shared ownership. And when you've got a group of people that are all super talented, all rowing in the same direction towards a shared goal, there isn't There aren't many things you can do better in life, is there?
No. And in terms of the future, Liz, just talk a little about your thoughts and plans for the future.
Well, so our goal is to become the most impactful corporate finance advisor. So we've made a commitment that 30% of the money we make will be invested in impact. So whether that's charities or investing in those businesses that, will change the world, that's our focus, and doing that with and through our fellows as well. So our clients post-deal. That's our future. So that's what we're working towards, is how can we, as a fairly small business, have a global impact and make sure that we do our bit? We've all got kids, lots of us have got children here, and most of us really care deeply about the legacy we leave behind being better for our future, being good for our country. So that's our future. Most impactful corporate finance advisor.
Well, it's an inspirational story, Liz. And it's been a huge pleasure chatting to you on this edition of the podcast. And I wish you and all of your co-owners every success in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.